Side 10. She looked again at the computer graphics. The five-fold symmetry of the dodecahedron was reflected in the five interior chairs, each facing a pentagonal surface. So it's our contention, Dr. Lunacharsky and I, that the five chairs are meant for us, for people. That would mean that the interior chamber of the machine is only a few meters across, the exterior perhaps 10 or 20 meters across. The technology is undoubtedly formidable, but we don't think we're talking about building something the size of a city or as complex as an aircraft carrier. We might very well be able to build this, whatever it is, if we all work together. What I'm trying to say is that you don't put chairs inside a bomb. I don't think this is a doomsday machine or a Trojan horse. I agree with what Dr. Sukhavati said, or maybe only implied. The idea that this is a Trojan horse is itself an indication of how far we have to go. Again, there was an outburst. But this time, Derheer made no effort to stop it. Indeed, he actually turned the complainant's microphone on. It was the same delegate who had interrupted Sukhavati a few minutes earlier. Philip Biedenbaugh of the United Kingdom, a Labour Party minister in the shaky coalition government.
"Simply doesn't understand what our concern is. If it was literally a wooden horse, we would not be tempted to bring the alien device within the city gates. We have read our Homer, but flounce it up with some upholstery, and our suspicions are allayed. Why? Because we are being flattered or bribed. There's an historic adventure implied. There's the promise of new technologies. There's a hint of acceptance by, how to put it, greater beings. But I say no matter what lofty fantasies the radio astronomers may entertain, if there is even a tiny chance the machine is a means of destruction, it should not be built. Better, as the Soviet delegate has proposed, to burn the data tapes and make the construction of radio telescopes a capital crime." The meeting was becoming unruly. Scores of delegates were electronically queuing for authorization to speak. The hubbub rose to a subdued roar that reminded Ellie of her years of listening to radio astronomical static. A consensus did not seem readily within reach, and the co-chairmen were clearly unable to restrain the delegates. As the Chinese delegate rose to speak, the vitagraphics were slow to appear on Ellie's screen, and she looked around for help. She had no idea who this man was either. Nian Bobby Bui, a National Security Council staffer, now assigned to Derheer, leaned over and said, "Shi Kamyu's his name. Spelled X-I. Pronounced Shi. Heavy dude. Born on the Long March. Volunteer as a teenager in Korea. Government official, mainly political. Knocked down for a 9-count in the Cultural Revolution. Central Committee member now. Very influential. Been in the news lately. Also directs Chinese archaeological digging." Shi Kuamyu was a tall, broad-shouldered man around 60. The wrinkles on his face made him seem older, but his posture and physique gave him an almost youthful appearance. He wore his tunic buttoned at the collar in the fashion that was as obligatory for Chinese political leaders as three-piece suits were for American governmental leaders. The president, of course, accepted. The vitagraphics now came through on her console, and she could remember having read a long article about Shi Kuamyu in one of the video news magazines.
"If we are frightened," he was saying, "we will do nothing. That will delay them a little. But remember, they know we are here. Our television arrives at their planet. Every day they are reminded of us. Have you looked at our television programs? They will not forget us. If we do nothing, and if they are worried about us, they will come to us, machine or no machine. We cannot hide from them. If we had kept quiet, we would not face this problem. If we had cable television only, and no big military radar, then maybe they would not know about us. But now it is too late. We cannot go back. Our course is set. If you are seriously frightened about this machine destroying the Earth, do not build it on the Earth.
Build it somewhere else.
Then, if it is a doomsday machine and blows up a world, it will not be our world.
But this will be very expensive. Probably too expensive. Or if we are not so frightened, build it in some isolated desert. You could have a very big explosion in the Tokopi wasteland in Xinjiang province and still kill nobody. And if we are not frightened at all, we can build it in Washington, or Moscow, or Beijing, or in this beautiful city. In ancient China, Vega and two nearby stars were called Qianyu. It means the young woman with the spinning wheel. It is an auspicious symbol, a machine to make new clothes for the people of the Earth. We have received an invitation, a very unusual invitation. Maybe it is to go to a banquet. The Earth has never been invited to a banquet before. It would be impolite to refuse.
Chapter 12. The One Delta Isomer. Looking at the stars always makes me dream, as simply as I dream over the black dots representing towns and villages on a map. Why, I ask myself, shouldn't the shining dots of the sky be as accessible as the black dots on the map of France? Vincent van Gogh. It was a splendid autumn afternoon, so unseasonably warm that Devi Sukhavati had left her coat behind. She and Ellie walked along the crowded Champs-Élysées toward the Place de la Concorde. The ethnic diversity was rivaled by London, Manhattan, and only a few other cities on the planet. Two women walking together, one in a skirt and sweater, the other in a sari, were in no way unusual. Outside a tobacconist's, there was a long, orderly, and polyglot line of people attracted by the first week of legalized sale of cured cannabis cigarettes from the United States. By French law, they could not be sold to or consumed by those under 18 years of age. Many in line were middle-aged and older. Some might have been naturalized Algerians or Moroccans. Especially potent varieties of cannabis were grown, mainly in California and Oregon, for the export trade. Featured here was a new and admired strain, which had, in addition, been grown in ultraviolet light, converting some of the inert cannabinoids into the one delta isomer. It was called Sunkissed. The package, illustrated in a window display a meter and a half high, bore in French the slogan, "This will be deducted from your share in paradise." The shop windows along the boulevard were a riot of color. The two women bought chestnuts from a street vendor and reveled in the taste and texture. For some reason, every time Ellie saw a sign advertising BNP, the Banque Nationale de Paris, she read it as the Russian word for beer, with the middle letter inverted left to right. Beer. The signs, lately corrupted from their usual and respectable fiduciary vocations, seemed to be exhorting her. Russian beer. The incongruity amused her, and only with difficulty could she convince the part of her brain in charge of reading that this was the Latin, not the Cyrillic alphabet. Further on, they marveled at l'obélisque, an ancient military commemorative, stolen at great expense to become a modern military commemorative. They decided to walk on. Turhier had broken the date, or at least that's what it amounted to. He had called her up this morning, apologetic, but not desperately so. There were too many political issues being raised at the plenary session. The Secretary of State was flying in tomorrow, interrupting a visit to Cuba. Turhier's hands were full, and he hoped Ellie would understand. She understood. She hated herself for sleeping with him. To avoid an afternoon alone, she had dialed Devi Sukhavati. One of the Sanskrit words for victorious is Abhijit. That's what Vega was called in ancient India, Abhijit. It was under the influence of Vega that the Hindu divinities, our culture heroes, conquered the Asuras, the gods of evil. Ellie, are you listening?
Now, it's a curious thing. In Persia, there are asuras also, but in Persia, the asuras were the gods of good. Eventually, religion sprang up in which the chief god, the god of light, the sun god, was called Ahura Mazda. The Zoroastrians, for example, and the Mithrasts. Ahura, Asura, it's the same name. There are still Zoroastrians today, and the Mithrahists gave the early Christians a good fright. But in the same story, those Hindu divinities, they were mainly female, by the way, were called Devis. That's the origin of my own name. In India, the Devis are gods of good. In Persia, the Devis become gods of evil. Some scholars think this is where the English word devil ultimately comes from. The symmetry is complete. All this is probably some vaguely remembered account of the Aryan invasion that pushed the Dravidians, my ancestors, to the south. So depending on which side of the Kirtar range one lives on, Vega supports either God or the devil. This cheerful story had been proffered as a gift by Devi, who clearly had heard something of Ellie's California religious adventures 2 weeks before. Ellie was grateful. But it reminded her that she had not even mentioned to Joss the possibility that the message was the blueprint for a machine of unknown purpose. Now he would soon enough be hearing all this through the media. She should really, she told herself sternly, make an overseas call to explain to him the new developments. But Joss was said to be in seclusion. He had offered no public statement following their meeting in Modesto. Rankin, in a press conference, announced that while there might be some dangers, he was not opposed to letting the scientists receive the full message. But translation was another matter. Periodic review by all segments of society was required, he said, especially by those entrusted to safeguard spiritual and moral values. They were now approaching the Tuileries Gardens, where the garish hues of autumn were on display. Frail and elderly men, Ellie judged them to be from Southeast Asia, were in vigorous dispute. Ornamenting the black cast-iron gates were multicolored balloons on sail. At the center of a pool of water was a marble amphitrite. Around her, toy sailboats were racing, urged on by an exuberant crowd of small children with Magellanic aspirations. A catfish suddenly broke water, swamping the lead boat, and the boys and girls became subdued, chastened by this wholly unexpected apparition. The sun was low in the west, and Ellie felt a momentary chill. They approached l'Orangerie, in the annex of which was a special exhibition, so the poster proclaimed, Image Martienne. The joint American-French-Soviet robot roving vehicles on Mars had produced a spectacular windfall of color photographs. Some, like the Voyager images of the outer solar system around 1980, soaring beyond their mere scientific purpose and becoming art. The poster featured a landscape photographed on the vast Elysium Plateau. In the foreground was a three-sided pyramid, smooth, highly eroded, with an impact crater near the base. It had been produced by millions of years of high-speed sandblasting by the fierce Martian winds, the planetary geologists had said. A second rover, assigned to Sidonia on the other side of Mars, had become mired in a drifting dune, and its controllers in Pasadena had been so far unable to respond to its forlorn cries for help. Ellie found herself riveted on Sukhavati's appearance. Her huge black eyes, erect bearing, and yet another magnificent sari. She thought to herself, I'm not graceful. Usually she found herself able to continue her part of a conversation while mentally addressing other matters as well. But today she had trouble following one line of thought, never mind two. While they were discussing the merits of the several opinions on whether to build the machine, in her mind's eye, she returned to Devi's image from the Aryan invasion of India 3,500 years ago. A war between two peoples, each of whom claimed victory, each of whom patriotically exaggerated the historical accounts.
Ultimately, the story is transformed into a war of the gods. Our side, of course, is good. The other side, of course, is evil. She imagined the goateed, spade-tailed, cloven-hoofed devil of the West evolving by slow evolutionary steps over thousands of years from some Hindu antecedent who, for all Ellie knew, had the head of an elephant and was painted blue. Baruta's Trojan horse? Maybe it's not a completely foolish idea, she found herself saying. But I don't see that we have any choice, as she said. They can be here in 20-some-odd years if they want to. They arrived at a monumental arch, in the Roman style, surmounted by a heroic, indeed apotheotic statue of Napoleon as chariot driver. From the long view, from an extraterrestrial perspective, how pathetic this posturing was. They rested on a nearby bench, their long shadows cast over a bed of flowers planted in the colors of the French Republic. Ellie longed to discuss her own emotional predicament, but that might have political overtones. It would at the very least be indiscreet. She did not know Sukhavati very well. Instead, she encouraged her companion to speak about her personal life. Sukhavati acquiesced readily enough. She had been born to a Brahmin but unprosperous family with matriarchal proclivities in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. Matriarchal households were still common all over South India. She matriculated at Banaras Hindu University. At medical school in England, she had met and fallen deeply in love with Surinder Ghosh, a fellow medical student. But Surinder was a Harijan, an untouchable, of a caste so loathed that the mere sight of them was held by orthodox Brahmins to be polluting. Surinder's ancestors had been forced to live a nocturnal existence, like bats and owls. Her family threatened to disown her if they married. Her father declared that he had no daughter who would consider such a union. If she married Ghosh, he would mourn her as though she were dead. She married him anyway. "We were too much in love," she said. "I really had no choice." Within the year, he died from septicemia, acquired while performing an autopsy under inadequate supervision. Instead of reconciling her to her family, however, Surinder's death accomplished the opposite. And after receiving her medical degree, Devi decided to remain in England. She discovered a natural affinity for molecular biology and considered it an effortless continuation of her medical studies. She soon found she had real talent in this meticulous discipline. Knowledge of nucleic acid replication led her to work on the origin of life, and that in turn led her to consider life on other planets.
"You could say that my scientific career has been a sequence of free associations. One thing just led to another."
She had recently been working on the characterization of Martian organic matter, measured in a few locales on Mars by the same roving vehicles whose stunning photographic products they had just seen advertised. Davy had never remarried, although she made it plain there were some who pursued her. Lately she had been seeing a scientist in Bombay, whom she described as a computerwala. Walking a little farther on, they found themselves in the Cœur Napoléon, the interior courtyard of the Louvre Museum. In its center was the newly completed and wildly controversial pyramidal entrance, and in high niches around the courtyard were sculptural representations of the heroes of French civilization. Captured under each statue of a revered man, they could see little evidence of revered women, was his surname. Occasionally, letters were eroded by natural weathering, or in a few cases perhaps effaced by some offended passerby. For one or two statues, it was difficult to piece together who the savant had been. On the statue that had evidently evoked the greatest public resentment, only the letters LTA remained. Although the sun was setting and the Louvre was open until mid-evening, they did not enter, but instead ambled along the Seine embankment, following the river back along the Quai d'Orsay. The proprietors of bookstalls were fastening shutters and closing up shop for the day. For a while they strolled on, arm in arm in the European manner. A French couple was walking a few paces ahead of them, each parent holding one hand of their daughter, a girl of about 4, who would periodically launch herself off the pavement. In her momentary suspension in 0G, she experienced, it was apparent, something akin to ecstasy. The parents were discussing the World Message Consortium, which was hardly a coincidence since the newspapers had been full of little else. The man was for building the machine. It might create new technologies and increase employment in France. The woman was more cautious, but for reasons she had difficulty articulating. The daughter, braids flying, was wholly unconcerned about what to do with a blueprint from the stars. Derheer, Kitts, and Honeycutt had called a meeting at the American Embassy early the following morning to prepare for the arrival of the Secretary of State later in the day. The meeting was to be classified and held in the embassy's black room, a chamber electromagnetically decoupled from the outside world, making even sophisticated electronic surveillance impossible. Or so it was claimed. Ellie thought there might be instrumentation developed that could make an end run around these precautions. After spending the afternoon with Devi Sukhavati, she had received the message at her hotel and had tried to call Derheer, but was able only to reach Michael Kitts. She opposed a classified meeting on this subject, she said. It was a matter of principle. The message was clearly intended for the entire planet. Kitts replied that there were no data being withheld from the rest of the world, at least by Americans, and that the meeting was merely advisory, to assist the United States in the difficult procedural negotiations ahead. He appealed to her patriotism, to her self-interest, and at last invoked again the Haddon decision. "For all I know, that thing is still sitting in your safe unread. Read it," he urged. She tried again unsuccessfully to reach Derheer. "First the man turns up everywhere in the Argus facility like a bad penny. He moves in with you in your apartment. You're sure, for the first time in years, you're in love. The next minute you can't even get him to answer the phone." She decided to attend the meeting, if only to see Ken face to face. Kitts was enthusiastically for building the machine. Drumlin cautiously in favor, Derheer and Honeycutt at least outwardly uncommitted, and Peter Valerian in an agony of indecision. Kitts and Drumlin were even talking about where to build the thing. Freightage costs alone made manufacture or even assembly on the far side of the moon prohibitively expensive, as she had guessed. "If we use aerodynamic braking, it's cheaper to send a kilogram to Phobos or Deimos than to the far side of the moon," Bobby Bui volunteered. "Where the hell is Phobos or Deimos?" Kitts wanted to know. "The moon's a Mars. I was talking about aerodynamic braking in the Martian atmosphere." "And, how long does it take to get to Phobos or Deimos?" Drumlin was stirring his cup of coffee. "Maybe a year. But once we have a fleet of interplanetary transfer vehicles and the pipeline is full..." "Compared with 3 days to the moon," sputtered Drumlin. "Bui, stop wasting our time." "It's only a suggestion," he protested. "You know, just something to think about." Derheer seemed impatient, distracted. He was clearly under great pressure, alternately avoiding her eyes and, she thought, making some unspoken appeal. She took it as a hopeful sign.
"If you want to worry about doomsday machines," Drumlin was saying, "you have to worry about energy supplies. If it doesn't have access to an enormous amount of energy, it can't be a doomsday machine. So as long as the instructions don't ask for a gigawatt nuclear reactor, I don't think we have to worry about doomsday machines."
"Why are you guys in such a hurry to commit to construction?" she asked Kitts and Drumlin collectively. They were sitting next to each other, with a plate of croissant between them. Kitts looked from Honeycutt to Derheer before answering.
"This is a classified meeting," he began. "We all know you won't pass anything said here on to your Russian friends. It's like this. We don't know what the machine will do,
but it's clear from Dave Drumlin's analysis that there's new technology in it, probably new industries. Constructing the machine is bound to have economic value. I mean, think of what we'd learn. And it might have military value. At least that's what the Russians are thinking. See, the Russians are in a box. Here's a whole new area of technology they're going to have to keep up with the U.S. on. Maybe there's instructions for some decisive weapon in the message or some economic advantage. They can't be sure. They'll have to bust their economy trying. Did you notice how Beruda kept referring to what was cost-effective? If all this message stuff went away, burn the data, destroy the telescopes, then the Russians could maintain military parity. That's why they're so cautious. So, of course, that's why we're gung-ho for it. He smiled. Temperamentally, Kitz was bloodless, she thought. But he was far from stupid. When he was cold and withdrawn, people tended not to like him. So he had developed an occasional veneer of urbane amiability. In Ellie's view, it was a molecular monolayer thick. "Now let me ask you a question," he continued. "Did you catch Beruda's remark about withholding some of the data? Is there any missing data?" "Only from very early on," she replied. "Only from the first few weeks, I guess. There were a few holes in the Chinese coverage a little after that. There's still a small amount of data that hasn't been exchanged on all sides. But I don't see any signs of serious holding back. Anyway, we'll pick up any missing data swatches after the message recycles."
"If the message recycles," Drumlin growled.
Jurhir moderated a discussion on contingency planning, what to do when the primer was received, which American, German, and Japanese industries to notify early about possible major development projects, how to identify key scientists and engineers for constructing the machine, if the decision was made to go ahead, and, briefly, the need to build enthusiasm for the project in Congress and with the American public. Jurhir hastened to add that these would be contingency plans only, that no final decision was being made, and that no doubt Soviet concerns about a Trojan horse were at least partly genuine. Kitz asked about the composition of the crew. "They're asking us to put people in 5 upholstered chairs." "Which people? How do we decide? It'll probably have to be an international crew. How many Americans? How many Russians? Anybody else? We don't know what happens to those 5 people when they sit down in those chairs, but we want to have the best men for the job." Ellie did not rise to the bait, and he continued. "Now a major question is going to be who pays for what? Who builds what? Who's in charge of overall systems integration? I think we can do some real horse trading on this, in exchange for significant American representation in the crew."
But we still want to send the best possible people,"
Jurhir noted, a little obviously.
"Sure," returned Kitz. "But what do we mean by best? Scientists? People with military intelligence backgrounds? Physical strength and endurance? Patriotism? That's not a dirty word, you know." "And then," he looked up from buttering another croissant to glance directly at Ellie, "there's the question of sex. Sexes, I mean. Do we send only men? If it's men and women, there has to be more of one sex than the other. There's 5 places, an odd number. Are all the crew members going to work together okay? If we go ahead with this project, there's going to be a lot of tough negotiation."
"This doesn't sound right to me," said Ellie. "This isn't some ambassadorship you buy with a campaign contribution. This is serious business. Also, do you want some muscle-bound moron up there? Some kid in his 20s who knows nothing about how the world works? Just how to run a respectable 100-yard dash and how to obey orders? Or some political hack? That can't be what this trip is about."
"No, you're right," Kitz smiled. "I think we'll find people who satisfy all our criteria."
Jurhir, the bags under his eyes, making him look almost haggard, adjourned the meeting. He managed to give Ellie a small, private smile, but it was all lips, no teeth. The embassy limousines were waiting to take them back to the Elysee Palace.
"I'll tell you why it would be better to send Russians," Vege was saying. "When you Americans were opening up your country, Pioneers, trappers, Indian scouts, all that. You are unopposed, at least by anyone at your level of technology. You raced across your continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific. After a while, you expected everything would be easy. Our situation was different. We were conquered by the Mongols. Their host technology was much superior to ours. When we expanded eastward, we were careful. We never crossed the wilderness and expected it would be easy. We're more adjusted to adversity than you are. Also, Americans are used to being ahead technologically. We're used to catching up technologically. Now everybody on Earth is a Russian. You understand? I mean, in our historical position. This mission needs Soviets more than it needs Americans.
Merely meeting with her alone entailed certain risks for Vege, and for her as well, as Kitz had gone out of his way to remind her. Sometimes, during a scientific meeting in America or Europe, Vege would be permitted to spend an afternoon with her. More often, he was accompanied by colleagues or a KGB babysitter, who would be described as a translator, even when his English was clearly inferior to Vege's, or as a scientist from the secretariat of this or that academy commission, except that his knowledge of the scientific matters often proved superficial. Vege would shake his head when asked about them. But, by and large, he considered the babysitters a part of the game, the price you must pay when they let you visit the West. And more than once she thought she detected a note of affection in Vege's voice when he talked to the babysitter. To go to a foreign country and pretend to be expert in a subject you know poorly must be filled with anxiety. Perhaps in their heart of hearts, the babysitters detested their assignment as much as Vege did. They were seated at the same window table at Chez Dieu. A distinct chill was in the air, a premonition of winter, and a young man wearing a long blue scarf as his only concession to the cold strode briskly past the tubs of chilled oysters outside the window. From Lunacharsky's continuing and uncharacteristically guarded remarks, she deduced disarray in the Soviet delegation. The Soviets were concerned that the machine might somehow redound to the strategic advantage of the United States in the five-decade-old global competition. Vege had, in fact, been shocked by Baruta's question about burning the data and destroying the radio telescopes. He had had no advance knowledge of Baruta's position.
The Soviets had played a vital role in gathering the message with the largest longitudinal coverage of any nation, Vege stressed,
and they had the only serious ocean-going radio telescopes. They would expect a major role in whatever came next. Ellie assured him that as far as she was concerned, they should have such a role. Look, Vege, they know from our television transmissions that the Earth rotates, and that there are many different nations. The Olympic broadcast alone might have told them that. Subsequent transmissions from other nations would have nailed it down. So if they're as good as we think, they could have phased the transmission with the Earth's rotation, so only one nation got the message. They chose not to do that. They want the message to be received by everybody on the planet. They're expecting the machine to be built by the whole planet. This can't be an all-American or an all-Russian project. It's not what our client wants. But she was not sure, she told him, that she would be playing any role in decisions on machine construction or crew selection. She was returning to the United States the next day, mainly to get on top of the new radio data from the past few weeks. The consortium plenary sessions seemed interminable, and no closing date had been set. Vege had been asked by his people to stay on at least a little longer. The foreign minister had just arrived and was now leading the Soviet delegation.
"I'm worried all this will end badly," he said. "There are so many things that can go wrong. Technological failures, political failures, human failures. And even if we get through all that, if we don't have a war because of the machine, if we build it correctly and without blowing ourselves up, I'm still worried."
"About what? How do you mean?" "The best that can happen is we will be made fools of."
"Who will?" "Arroway, don't you understand?"
A vein in Lunacharsky's neck throbbed.
"I'm amazed you don't see it. The Earth is a ghetto. Yes, a ghetto. All human beings are trapped here. We have heard vaguely that there are big cities out there beyond the ghetto, with broad boulevards filled with droskies and beautiful perfumed women in furs. But the cities are too far away, and we are too poor ever to go there, even the richest of us. Anyway, we know they don't want us. That's why they've left us in this pathetic little village in the first place. And now along comes an invitation. As she said, fancy. Elegant. They have sent us an engraved card and an empty droshky. We are to send 5 villagers, and the droshky will carry them to, who knows, Warsaw or Moscow? Maybe even Paris? Of course, some are tempted to go. There will always be people who are flattered by the invitation or who think it is a way to escape our shabby village. And what do you think will happen when we get there? Do you think the Grand Duke will have us to dinner? Will the president of the academy ask us interesting questions about daily life in our filthy shtetl? Do you imagine the Russian Orthodox metropolitan will engage us in learned discourse on comparative religion? No, Arroway. We will gawk at the big city, and they will laugh at us behind their hands. They will exhibit us to the curious. The more backward we are, the better they'll feel, the more reassured they'll be. It's a quota system. Every few centuries, 5 of us get to spend a weekend on Vega. Have pity on the provincials, and make sure they know who their betters are.
Chapter 13. Babylon. With the basest of companions, I walked the streets of Babylon. Augustine. Confessions 2-3. The Cray-21 mainframe computer at Argus had been instructed to compare each day's harvest of data from Vega with the earliest records of Level 3 of the palimpsest. In effect, one long and incomprehensible sequence of zeros and ones was being compared automatically with another, earlier such sequence. This was part of a massive statistical intercomparison of various segments of the still undecrypted text. There were some short sequences of zeros and ones. Words, the analysts called them hopefully, which were repeated again and again. Many sequences would appear only once in thousands of pages of text. This statistical approach to message decryption was familiar to Ellie since high school. But the subroutines, supplied by the experts from the National Security Agency, made available only as a result of a presidential directive, and even then armed with instructions to self-destruct if examined closely, were brilliant. What prodigies of human inventiveness, Ellie reflected, were being directed to reading each other's mail. The global confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union, now, to be sure, easing somewhat, was still eating up the world. It was not just the financial resources dedicated to the military establishments of all nations. That was approaching $2 trillion a year. And by itself was ruinously expensive when there were so many other urgent human needs. But still worse, she knew, was the intellectual effort dedicated to the arms race. Almost half the scientists on the planet, it had been estimated, were employed by one or another of the almost 200 military establishments worldwide. And they were not the dregs of the doctoral programs in physics and mathematics. Some of her colleagues would console themselves with this thought when the awkward problem arose of what to tell a recent doctoral candidate being courted by, say, one of the weapons laboratories.
If he was any good, he'd be offered an assistant professorship at Stanford, at least, she could recall Drumlin once saying.
Nope. A certain kind of mind and character was drawn to the military applications of science and mathematics. People who liked big explosions, for example. Or those with no taste for personal combat, who, to avenge some schoolyard injustice, aspired to military command. Or inveterate puzzle solvers, who longed to decrypt the most complex messages known. Occasionally the spur was political, tracing back to international disputes, immigration policies, wartime horrors, police brutality, or national propaganda by this nation or that decades earlier. Many of these scientists had real ability, Ellie knew, whatever reservations she might have about their motivations. She tried to imagine that massed talent really dedicated to the well-being of the species and the planet. She pored over the studies that had accumulated during her absence. They were making almost no progress in decrypting the message, although the statistical analyses now stacked into a pile of paper a meter tall. It was all very discouraging. She wished there were someone, especially a close woman friend at Argus, to whom she could pour out her hurt and anger at Ken's behavior. But there was not, and she was disinclined even to use the telephone for this purpose. She did manage to spend a weekend with her college friend, Becky Ellenbogen, in Austin. But Becky, whose appraisals of men tended to be somewhere between wry and scathing, in this case was surprisingly mild in her criticism. "He is the president's science advisor, and this is only the most amazing discovery in the history of the world. Don't be so hard on him," Becky urged. "He'll come around." But Becky was another of those who found Ken charming. She had met him once at the dedication of the National Neutrino Observatory, and was perhaps too inclined to accommodate to power. Had Drahir treated Ellie in this shabby way while he was a mere professor of molecular biology somewhere, Becky would have marinated and skewered the man. After returning from Paris, Drahir had mustered a regular campaign of apology and devotion. He had been overstressed, he told her, overwhelmed with a range of responsibilities, including difficult and unfamiliar political issues. His position as leader of the American delegation and co-chairman of the plenary might have been rendered less effective if there had been public knowledge of his and Ellie's relationship. Kits had been insufferable. Ken had had too many consecutive nights with only a few hours' sleep. Altogether, Ellie judged, there were too many explanations. But she permitted the relationship to continue. When it happened, it was Willie once again, this time on the graveyard shift, who first noticed. Afterward, Willie would attribute the speed of the discovery less to the superconducting computer and the NSA programs than to the new Haddon context recognition chips. At any rate, Vega had been low in the sky an hour or so before dawn when the computer triggered an understated alarm. With some annoyance, Willie put down what he was reading. It was a new textbook on fast Fourier transform spectroscopy, and noticed these words being printed out on the screen. Repeat text pages 41,617 to 41,619. Bit mismatch. 0/2271. Correlation coefficient 0.99+. As he watched, 41,619 became 41,620, and then 41,621. The digits after the slash were increasing in a continuous blur. Both the number of pages and the correlation coefficient, a measure of the improbability that the correlation was by chance, increased as he watched. He gave it another two pages before picking up the direct line to Ellie's apartment. End of side 10.